breaks out, nothing but silence from the mainstream media show. We want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence. Challenging silence.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Nagler. Today on our show, we're going to talk about a certain archetype that is a part of our human existence, the trickster. It's an age-old scenario, a person tricking others into doing something that is against their interest and for his or her own personal gain. And how do we identify a trickster, and how does it influence our politics today? And at the same time, we want to explore how can nonviolence turn the tables even on a trickster who's working for their own personal interests. How can nonviolence help to build a movement that works for the interests of all? So to get us started in this conversation, I'm going to bring in Michael Nagler, co-founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program, also my co-host and colleague here at Nonviolence Radio. Michael.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. Yeah, that's an interesting topic. I was pleased to note recently a comment by Van Jones on the character of the president-elect. He said, this person, I won't use his name right now, this person is a seriously tricky dude, he said. This is Tricky Dick on steroids. And, of course, I'm from an era that remembers the regime, the vice presidentship, and the presidency of Richard Nixon, who was popularly known as Tricky Dick. And I had some friends in the CEO world, not many, of course, but one of them, who was actually a fraternity brother of mine, came back from a big meeting with all of these highly placed financial and business people and said that they were saying, so trick us. In other words, they really wanted to be tricked. And that has become increasingly common in this post-truth era, where the interest in truth, the dedication to truth has waned, as in no era that I've ever experienced in my long life. And then, so what does that leave you with? If truth isn't reliable, you want someone who's cunning. And you identify with that person, and you think, this is the psychology of trickster archetypes, I believe, you think that their cunning is going to benefit you. It's the same psychology by which people vote or support kings and queens, you know, even though they can be rather abusive and unkind. Still, in your helplessness and weakness, you identify yourself with the sovereign, and that gives you a spurious feeling of strength and capacity.
Thank you, Michael, for getting us started on this. Now, I'd like to try to understand a little bit better what you mean by a trickster archetype. Can you explain the idea of an archetype and how this is an unconscious process that we might identify with an archetype?
Yeah, this goes back, Stephanie, to my background in comparative literature and teaching ancient mythology. The characters in ancient story are generally more typological than personal, than realistic. You know, in modern fiction, we expect a person to be very vivid and step out of the page with all their, you know, wrinkles and individual characteristics. But in ancient literature, you were looking more at certain types. And one of those types at certain periods was what we call in anthropology the trickster. Coyote is a good example of that from Native American mythologies. And the characteristics are they're very cunning. They are deceitful. They're not extremely destructive, by and large. They're not, you know, this is not the dark side personified. But they're cunning, and they get their own way, and they tend to succeed. And so there's a strong sense that I had in watching the electoral process that Mr. Trump was, how shall we put this, kind of being seen against that background. One of the results was that every time somebody dug up some dirt about him, a scandal, a deprecation of women, an extremely vulgar remark, people of a progressive persuasion thought, aha, well, you know, now he's sunk. Everybody's going to see what he's really made of. But the fact is that he went up higher in the esteem of certain people. And so if we want to address that, we need to ask ourselves, why are people operating on such a non-rational level?
Okay, so to help bring this conversation out a little bit more, I want to bring in a theory from nonviolence scholar, the late Walter Wink, who in an article called Jesus, as a nonviolent activist, he called him a nonviolent rebel trickster. And some of the examples he gives, how can we understand Jesus as a nonviolent rebel trickster? Well, the idea of turn the other cheek. And I know that there could be some contention to this, to his theory, but let me put it out there anyways, that he said that if somebody slaps you on the left cheek, then turn the other cheek. And what would happen is basically there's a hierarchy. So if you're being slapped by somebody higher than you, they're going to slap you as, say, as a slave or as somebody that's lower than them, and they're going to slap you with the backside of their hand. If you turn the other cheek, it's not so much a question of forgiveness, but about taking on suffering to show your dignity. If you turn the other cheek, they're therefore forced to then hit you with the palm of their hand, which is reserved for gentlemen and people of their equals. So that was one way that Jesus was telling them to assert your dignity in the face of humiliation and suffering. Another one being that if somebody asks your cloak of you, also give them your shirt, or I'm not too...
Tunic.
Your tunic, your woven garment. And what the rebel trickster element in that is what? That if you have nothing, if you're poor and you're being taken to court to pay for something that you don't, the money that you don't have, you give somebody your cloak, sure, but, and then give them your other garment, but maybe you don't have another garment, or maybe that's the only garment that you have. And so then you expose, instead of being humiliated yourself, you're exposing the other person to a sense of shame of what they're doing to you by seeing you have nothing else, absolutely nothing else. And then the third hypothesis that he has is in terms of if somebody asks you to walk a mile with them, then walk an extra mile. And apparently Roman soldiers had a law, actually, if they asked you to carry something for them, you had to walk a mile with them. So to walk the extra mile means then not only following the law, but then taking on the suffering yourself to say, oh, no, I'm going to keep with you. So Walter Wink offers these ideas as a way of showing the way that Jesus's nonviolence was a sort of a trickster nonviolence. And so now let's analyze the contrast a bit in terms of what's the difference and how can we bring out the understanding of this archetype of trickster better. Michael.
Wow. Thank you, Stephanie. Let me say a few things here. First of all, I think to use the term trickster of an avatar figure like Jesus is to stretch it beyond any kind of conceivable meaning. You know, as as an anthropologist, I can't do that. I can't go along with
it. Okay, but for the sake of understanding a dynamic, which is a kind of what is it? Gene Sharp, who coined the idea of a moral jujitsu, a way
it
of
is.
Turning. Energies back onto to harness energy and turning it around onto somebody who's trying to use it against you. So let's try to define a common understanding of a trickster dynamic and let go of the word in a sense. So
thank you. So I think that Wink is onto something there, and so was Gene Sharp. And the term that we use for it today is usually flipping the script.
Okay.
And
say more about that.
Yeah, a person, well, you like this story of Pauline Jacoby, who's in a parking lot in the east somewhere in the south. And she's an elderly woman. She's got disabilities, and she's gotten into her car after doing a little grocery shopping. And this is a true story. By the way, I'm not tricking you. Mm-hmm. And some guy jumps into the car, I believe with a knife, and says, give me all your money. And now the script is, his script is, she's terrified. And she pulls out all her money and gives it to him under duress. But she doesn't do that in reality. In reality, she said to him, young man, Jesus is with me in this car. She said, if you kill me, I'm going straight to heaven. And you are going straight to hell. Whereupon a conversation ensued, at the end of which the guy is crying. They both are. And this is not at all uncommon when you flip the script on an aggressive person. It leads to such cognitive dissonance that you see trembling, you see crying, interesting symptoms like that. Mm-hmm. So now here's where the script is really going to get flipped. Are you ready for this?
Okay.
As he's leaving the car, having sheathed his knife and full of apologies, she says, wait a minute, young man, and pulls out her wallet and gives him all her money. Mm-hmm. So willingly giving something that has been demanded of you, if you can really construe it in that way, that I will not give you anything under duress, you can even kill me, but of my own free will, mm-hmm. I would be happy to help you. It's a little bit like this wonderful Barbara Deming image, the two hands of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. That on the one hand, I will not put up with your injustice, but on the other hand, I am open to you as a human being. Mm-hmm. So how does that
show flipping the script?
For example, in the last example of Walter Wink uses, mm-hmm. and I want to get back to those three in a second, you are under duress demanding that someone walk a mile with you. Mm-hmm. And your script is that the person hates it. And at the end of the 1,000 paces, which is a Roman term for a mile, mm-hmm. they're going to slam down your heavy gear on the road and say, that's all you get, buddy. And they're going to go back to their life. And instead, you say, no, okay, you want a mile? I'll give you 2 miles. Mm-hmm. So you are exiting yourself, you're extricating yourself from that victimized posture.
Yeah.
That's what's really flipping the script.
Okay.
Now, I personally believe mm-hmm. that Walter was being a little bit, and I'm going to use a French term here, Stephanie, you ready for this? He was being a little bit recherché. He was trying to wring something out of the evidence that didn't have to be done. I think if we can trust those stories, and I could say a little bit more about that also, what Jesus was trying to do was to say, don't let yourself be victimized. Take agency in any way that you can. And there's an important concept that we've developed in the Meta Center, which is find out what they've got over you. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of hook does the oppressive regime have in you? Give that thing up, mm-hmm. and then you're free. So, for example, in India, the British took over legally, by legal maneuvering, they took over the salt production. And you can imagine in a tropical country how desperately people need salt. And Gandhi had them make their own salt. And that broke their dependency. They did no longer needed the British for salt, for cloth, for law courts, for education, for any of these things.
Mm-hmm. So flipping the script then is really about flipping one's own understanding of one's dignity or position in a situation. It's a bit of self-realization in terms of where one stands in the situation of conflict.
Yeah, that's well put. What you're doing is you're refusing to accept the aggressive person's role that he or she is trying to impose on you. And we know perfectly well that this happens on a very large scale, that where a whole class of people is disrespected, as was, you know, happening very widely here, they tend to take on the definition of themselves that the oppressor was offering. And the first step in getting freedom is to shed that identity. So you, now to recur to what you were just saying, Stephanie, you locate your sense of worth and dignity within you, which the attacking person is trying to deny, and you assert it in an unexpected way.
Mm-hmm.
And that changes the script. It changes the roles of the two persons in this drama.
So for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Nonviolence Radio, and I'm Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here with my co-host and colleague, Michael Negler. And what we're trying to understand is the archetype of the trickster, but also the idea of turning the tables in a scenario where you can, that can happen in violence and it can happen also in nonviolence. And we can really go deeper into the dynamics of nonviolence if we better understand the way that certain figures have used these powers to against themselves in a way. So if somebody's trying to take away your dignity implicitly, how to explicitly take it back through one's actions or words. So let's turn back to the president-elect, though, because that's now we're talking about the nonviolent side. But did he not represent as well people who felt like their voices were not heard? And so in a way, he was offering, as your theory is saying, basically a turning the tables on a political system. That's what he was trying to work with. Right? That
right.
He's saying, they've been tricking us for so long, they've been misleading us for so long, but we're going to do this to them now.
That's right.
So say a little bit about that, Michael.
I was just reading this morning in a very interesting book by Ken Wilber, a 90-page manuscript that you can get if you're a member of Cosmos. not a member of this Cosmos, C-O-S-M, we are all that, but a member of the Cosmos, the K-O-S-M-O-S organization and magazine. And incidentally, this is kind of a nice thing to that book. He says, I'm not putting any footnotes in here. If you're interested in any of this stuff, you can Google it. He quotes Nietzsche as using the term ressentiment, which means resentment in French, and among other things. And this is often the way that a trickster will operate. It will appeal to the lurking resentment in a person or persons and manipulate it in his or her own way. Now, I might hearken back to a play by Aristophanes, which is going back a long, long ways. In a play called The Birds, he has two very clever Athenians go up to a place in heaven called Nephelococcygia, which stands for Cloud Cuckoo Land. And this is a place inhabited by birds. And so these very clever Athenians, they get up and say, oh, unhappy birds. Now, the birds had no idea that they were unhappy. They have it fine, you know. They fly around in the heavens. But he got them convinced that they were oppressed, and then use them as a force to bring about their own political ends. And that is exactly what I think the president-elect has done. When I saw him standing behind Secretary Clinton during the, quote, debates, unquote, I'm putting that in quotes because nothing serious was actually debated. It was all on this level of archetypes and stereotypes.
Subconscious,
exactly. He stood behind her and glowered at her in a very, very unprofessional manner. And once again, naive as I am, I thought, well, you know, he's finished now. No one's going to imagine that this man could occupy such a high office. But I was dead wrong once again, because what he was doing was focusing people's resentment and using it for his own purposes, focusing it on a person whom he wanted to overcome in that particular context. So two really long-term destructive things are going on here. He's appealing to very low impulses that are, you know, deep in human animal evolution, and he's using them in a deceitful way to overcome key values in our society. And this goes back a long way. I mean, I remember how hurt I was when a certain president started taking off against the word liberal, because I self-identified as one of them. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, So this country was founded on a foundation of liberal democracy. Now you're taking that away. What are you going to replace it with? So what now, let's, there's a tricky issue here. Gandhi definitely needed to tap into the resentment of the Indian people. It's tricky. They were in a passive condition. They were accepting the overlordship of the Raj and their own inferiority and incapability of ruling themselves. And Gandhi actually had to tap into their resentment, their anger, and then quickly transfer it into constructive work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember that famous thing that Martin Luther King said so well, we did not give vent to outbursts of anger. We expressed, go ahead.
We expressed anger under discipline for maximum effect.
Perfect. Yeah, that's what he was able to do. And he was able to do that also with the concept of nationalism. Get people to have pride in the concept of the Indian nation. But go beyond that to identify what they were proud of in India as their ancient spiritual heritage and their ability to be of service to the rest of the world. So you have something that starts off, which is sometimes a perfectly legitimate trajectory, but you turn it to bad ends in the trickster and in the present campaign.
So that's the where you said we have to tread carefully around that and try to understand that somebody who seems to some to be saying things that are outrageous and that are that might work against him are actually working for him because of this archetype. And so that the nonviolence in return, and only nonviolence, can really address what's going on, has to keep in mind this idea of working with that underlying tendency toward some of the more chaotic forces in the human mind, such as resentment and anger and the feeling of not being free and oppressed, and those can be very strong. And so we need, as you said, Martin Luther King had pointed out, channels for it to be harnessed under discipline for maximum effect.
You know what? Here's why I love this program. As you were saying that, it occurred to me that we have a criterion for determining whether this is a malevolent trickster or someone who's trying to rouse us to a necessary and dignifying, ennobling action.
Mm-hmm.
And that is this resentment against persons?
Okay.
If it is, he's a trickster, she's a trickster, let's get out of here. See, Gandhi was very careful to say, I hate from the bottom of my heart the system of government that the British have set up in India, but I refuse to hate the overweening Britisher, just as I refuse to hate the overweening Hindu.
And that seems very important. So as a way of understanding if it's we need to work against a certain kind of a trickster, we can understand whether they're focused on people versus systems. And in that, we understand as well that if something is focused against people, it's setting people up for humiliation. And with humiliation comes even greater anger and greater sense of resentment and needing to use more humiliation and more of the same tactics to get even, and we just end up in a spiral of violence. So, but there's another theory in nonviolence that I want to bring out, and that is this idea of the paradox of repression, on the other hand.
Right.
And the opportunities that out-tricking a trickster really provide in the way of creating greater solidarity, making everybody more aware of what is effective action at this time. This is work that could have been started a long time ago, at the level that everybody is working now, but there was a sense of complacency. So the way that a somewhat seeming repressive leadership might, what it could offer is an opportunity for greater organizing and greater impact within the peace movement. Do you want to speak to that?
I do. That seems, in fact, to be exactly what is happening. I just got off the phone this morning with Michael Beer of Nonviolence International. An enormous amount of training is going on, and I'll be talking about some of those programs when we get over to the news part. But that is a very good analysis, that the paradox of repression is a way that a person who's being victimized is able to use what Gene Sharp called moral jujitsu. That is, after all is said and done, a person who is being aggressive, being violent, being deceitful, is vulnerable. They're vulnerable to their own deceit. And you have to find a way of tricking them out into the open, where suddenly what they've been doing is made visible in all of its ugliness.
Absolutely. And then that brings in the necessity of very strict nonviolent discipline in that moment, because that's the only thing that can expose the violence of a system, is if you can maintain that very strong sense that we are resisting your violence, and yet we're embracing you as a person, as you were quoting the Barbara Deming.
Not only that, that's absolutely correct, but not only that, if you take to violence, then you've blown apart the scenario, because you're no different from the person who has been attacking you. So the paradox of repression is whether you do this consciously, as I hope we sometimes will, or whether it just happens unconsciously, an aggressive person is being tricked into being so aggressive that it actually transcends the limit of the acceptable in the eyes of the reference public. And there are many examples of that. Unfortunately, there are examples where the violence can go very, very far without arousing that response. And the slaughter at Tiananmen Square was one example of that. So the secret, it seems to me, is to be constantly working not only on the issues that you're faced with, but on the culture, on the surrounding ambiance, so that people are not so desensitized that you have to suffer so, so much before it finally gets to the point where they can't stand it anymore.
Now, in practice, as people are training, getting trained in nonviolence, or are thinking about getting trained in nonviolence, one of the most important elements that it seems that needs to be included in these trainings, based on if we're trying to get smarter and we're trying to be able to anticipate what a response to our nonviolence will be, because I think that this program is helping really to bring that out, that when you offer nonviolence, do expect a reaction, because that's the point. We're bringing out a dynamic of violence. And it's a lot of people who get into nonviolence get surprised. Well, now they're beating us. we'll be prepared for that. So the need to really deeply prepare for what, if you make a move, a strategic move, what might their response be? What might an institution's response be? And then how can you continue grasping onto your principles and take your next step and your next step? But being aware that of what could be a variety of responses from the media, from politicians, from the police, from the entire institution that you are resisting, be prepared for that and be thinking about what their responses could be.
Yeah, as you're saying that, again, a kind of formula comes to my mind, where you have to be open to the best in the other person, but you have to be ready to expect the worst. It's a very subtle thing, because if you think, oh, these people are terrible, they're going to do nothing but attack us, you help to actually elicit that behavior, and this is not a learning experience. But if you can say, wow, what they're doing to us is bad, and it is the worst that they are capable of, but there also is something else lurking inside them that we're going to try to elicit. I don't know if I made that clear.
But. Well, it reminds me, I was talking about this with a friend this morning after meditation. We his view on it was this, that in the nonviolent, you know, in the nonviolent trickster model, somebody is thinking about the well-being of everybody. Their actions, their strategies have to do with the well-being of all. Gandhi would call this Sarvodaya, the uplift of everybody. Even if your actions seem inconsistent with your previous actions, what you're really trying to do is to include everybody in your vision of well-being. And the on the other side, a leader who is pursuing a trickster agenda for their own, they're looking at their own benefit in the end. So they're working for against your benefit versus a nonviolent movement, which is holding on to nonviolent discipline because you're trying to uphold the benefit of everybody. Is that could that be along the lines of what you were thinking?
Oh,
as well?
Completely. Mm-hmm. And I would add another element to that, that you can just watch out for the tendency to scapegoat. If the malevolent trickster will inevitably tip his or her hand because he will be saying, our well-being depends upon the suffering of another. And even if that other is very small, there's something terribly wrong with that dynamic. You know, we have this wonderful science fiction writer here in the East Bay, Ursula Le Guin, and she wrote a story called Those Who Rode Away from Omelas, mm-hmm. Omelas being Salem, Oregon, backwards. Mm-hmm. And it's about a fictional community where life is idyllic. But it turns out that the happiness of this blessed community depends on the suffering of one innocent child. And there's a group of inhabitants who find that out, and they ride away. They say, this is not right.
So that is showing what, that the need, can you just summarize the moral there?
The moral of the story, I guess, is if it's really... if the goal is really human welfare, mm-hmm. nobody should suffer,
and not even the so to be. Then you're also giving, I hope, the counsel to any movement that is working for justice and nonviolence, also not to scapegoat any president-elects or any leaders in the process as well. Right? This is not. It's an easy thing to do, to gang up and to use somebody as a rallying point for one's anger and hatred, but that's not getting rid of the hatred, and it's not rerouting our anger in a productive way.
It's expressing anger under indiscipline for minimum effect.
Thank you. Now, before we end this conversation for now and move on to the news, there was one story that I was thinking of as you were talking about the Pauline Jacoby, which I maybe would end this on, because it is also inspiring, and it's about this gentleman who was in a New York subway, and he was just, you know, going home at the end of the day, and a young man came up to him with a knife and said, give me your coat. And Diaz, I think his name was Alexander Diaz, he said, okay, sure. And he takes off his coat and he gives it to the kid. And then as he was sort of surprised that the guy just gave his coat up right away, but then he started to walk away. And then Diaz calls him back and he said, wait, here, how about, do you want a little bit of money too? You know, do you need some money? And he gave him his wallet. He said, oh, wait, no. First of all, he gave him his wallet. And then he said, wait, are you, must be cold. Here's my coat. And so this guy's really surprised, and he takes the coat. And then he said, maybe you're hungry. Let me take you to go get something to eat. And the guy actually decides, okay, sure, I guess I'll go with this guy to get something to eat. And they go to a restaurant, and he realizes all of these people. He goes to a restaurant that he knows really well, and he notices all these people know Diaz really well. And the bill comes, and it's time to pay, and Diaz says, you know, I would pay for this, but you have my wallet. And the young man very sheepishly just pushes his wallet back to him because he's been humanized at this point. And then he says, but I want one more thing. And he says, okay. He says, I want your knife. And the boy slides his knife over across the table to him as a story of really turning the tables on somebody who was going to do something against their best interest and somebody really taking on some bravery in a situation to help change that person's life.
Beautiful.
Raghupati Raghav Rajara Patiti Pavan Sitara Raghupati Raghav Rajara Patiti Pavan Sitara Raghupati Raghav Rajara Patiti Pavan Sitara Ali Ali Bolo Sare Ali Ali Bolo
pervades everything. It transcends the senses, while everything around me is ever changing, ever dying. There is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.
Ishwari Allah, tero naam, sabko sammati de bhagwan. Ishwari Allah, tero naam sabko sammati de bhagwan Ishwari Allah tero naam sabko sammati de bhagwan
You're listening to Nonviolence Radio. Let's turn now to a little bit of nonviolence in the news with Michael Nagler.
Stephanie, thank you. I'm going to actually repeat a couple of resources that I mentioned in our last program simply because they are such good ones. There's a website now called nonviolent-conflict.org, www.nonviolent-conflict.org. And it has a section called Nonviolent Conflict News. And this is a big step forward, I think, outside of Nonviolence Radio, which you're listening to now. There's very little in the way of specifically dedicated nonviolence news information and analysis. There's also an interesting model called the River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding in Florida, which I would invite you to check out. And a book by Pat Elder called Military Recruiting in the United States. It's, they say, longtime anti-war activist exposes the underworld of American military recruiting in this explosive and consequential book. And this will be relevant to the conversation that we were just having in the earlier part of the show. The book describes how recruiters manage to convince youth to enlist. And that brings up an issue that we didn't really talk about in the first half, but that I'd like to mention here. It's easy to do this because of our culture, because what's called the old story. In the old story, we're all separate. We're all material objects. And it's perfectly possible that my happiness could be built on your suffering. So when you go to young people who need a high goal to live for, that's, again, we're seeing that the trajectory of violence and nonviolence start off sometimes by appealing to the same real needs. But then the violent use of those needs is to divert them into something that will actually bring about the opposite. So you take these young people, they need idealism to live. It's a human need. And you say, aha, well, idealism is in killing other people for the benefit of this country. And they believe that because they have a culture that supports that belief. So that's why I was saying before that we should always be working on the level of the individual issue and also on the cultural narrative that supports that issue. Okay, well, I'll get off my soapbox here in just a second. Another website that I wanted to recommend again is mkgandhi.org, which is this huge repository of writings. buy-in about Gandhi, and it's getting something like 10,000 visits a day, which means that in one day, it gets almost as many hits as Google does in 1 second. And they have over 150 e-books on Gandhi that are available to download. Stephanie, you should send them your book, Gandhi Searches for Truth. They would love that. There are now four ways that your local community, especially your local faith community, can prepare for sanctuary. And this is shaping up to be the confrontational issue that will occur after January 20th. There's a national petition going around setting up a rapid response network in your city. Philadelphia has done this successfully. Michael Beer of Nonviolence International is working on this nationwide. We were just strategizing about this morning. And there's a related resource here in the website, Sanctuary Not Deportation. So we're asked to share that widely. And I think maybe at this point, I might talk about our pledge.
Say more, Michael. So when you want to talk about a pledge, what do you mean? A pledge of nonviolent resistance?
That's exactly what this one is called, a pledge of nonviolent resistance. Now, there's a bit of a backstory here.
That would be interesting to know.
Yeah, because a good friend of ours, Ken Buttigan, was instrumental in launching the Pledge of Resistance. I guess this would have been in the late 70s when the Reagan administration was threatening to invade Nicaragua. And of course, since I now have a Nicaraguan daughter-in-law, this is very personal for me. And the Pledge of Resistance worked in a very simple way. They gave out postcards, and you would send these postcards to the White House. And all they said was, if you invade Nicaragua, be prepared to face massive civil disobedience. That invasion never took place. And I firmly believe that it was partly because of that, I'm going to use a loaded word now, a nonviolence threat. So there is a role, even in nonviolence, for saying, if you do A, I'm going to have to do B. It's not exactly a threat, because a threat in Kenneth Boulding's sense is, if you do what I don't want, I'm going to do something you don't want.
Well, I think it's important to express boundaries in what we do and where our boundaries are as a movement. And if we don't have those, then we don't know when the right time to act is.
Wow, that is certainly true. And it's also a little bit like the paradox of repression, isn't it? Because you're saying if you go beyond a certain line, there's going to be a certain result which will thwart you. But even in thwarting them, here's our key once again, you're thwarting the behavior, not the person.
And I think that this has been a bit of a problem in a lot of the online activism that you see in terms of trying to keep somebody out of office or trying to keep somebody out of a certain position in office and so forth, is that people aren't expressing, well, what is the boundary when I'm going to change strategies? I don't want you to do this. I'm going to be upset about it, but I'm not willing to do more than make a couple of phone calls. And then and if it happens anyways, I'm going to be really upset. There's no sense of, if this happens, and I have worked for it not to happen, and there's a movement that I'm a part of, well, what are the next steps in terms of resistance? Instead of giving that to just a few groups to do, how ordinary people can get involved in big ways?
That's the big question. And, you know, it reminds me of an aspect of this which is important to recognize, and that is the people who want to push the country in an abusive, violent direction, they don't just explode into existence from nowhere. They do it gradually. They test the limits. The horrible example that comes to mind is the way Hitler brought about persecution of the Jews. He didn't round them all up and send them to execution camps right away. He did like one step and then another and another. And by doing it gradually, people accepted it. And I'm thinking of something that Rosalind Carter said about Ronald Reagan when her husband was running against him. She said about Reagan, the trouble with that man is he makes us feel good about our prejudices. Now, if you look at the recent presidential election, What we're seeing is simply an extended degree of that feeling good. So if, now to pick up on what you were saying, if people had said right then and there, this is not acceptable, and we're going to do everything that we can to stop it, it would not have deteriorated to the condition that we're in right now.
Or even if people were prepared for a possible scenario where somebody that they wanted to keep out of office got the office. There wasn't a sense, I think, of what do we do the day of after the election. There was more a sense of grieving and shock and people going through a number of different emotions, having difficult conversations. So, planning ahead.
I was recently on a panel with somebody, and Christine had a very interesting comment to make. She said the, what shall we call them, the ultra-conservatives are low on empathy and very strong on strategy. And progressives are very good at empathy and very bad at strategy.
Well, good on empathy for each other. I mean, I'd have to say progressives are low on empathy for those who disagree with them. And let's keep the conversation fair.
Let's talk about
nonviolence isn't for any one side, and that's what makes this program educational and interesting.
Yeah.
So talk about, you are offering a pledge of resistance. So people can understand what a pledge of resistance is. Why don't you share with people what that is?
Yes, here's the pledge, and I'm keeping it short. And by the way, the version that I'll be reading now has benefited from a number of comments that people taking it down off our website have mailed in. Mm-hmm. But, well, let me read the pledge, and then we'll get into the but.
Just read the pledge.
Just read the pledge, Nagler. Okay. I hereby pledge with joy and determination that during 2017 and for as long as it requires, I will, with all my strength and determination and in all ways open to me, with my given capacities and talents, resist the destruction of planet Earth, resist the tearing of the social fabric of my country, wherever it is threatened by prejudice, scapegoating, or any form of hatred, resist militarization and violence in everything from the mass media to actual practice, do whatever in me lies to build a world of peace and justice for all, and finally, learn and practice nonviolence by all means, constructive and obstructive, as the only way to do all this successfully and forever.
And that is your version of a pledge of resistance for the new year. And so people have written to you and they've said things such as, well, this language doesn't work for me, but I'm going to share language that does work for me. And they've sent that to you. And so it's been very interesting as well to see the way that people get inspired by having a template in front of them, and then they make it work for where they see their specific path and their specific duty in the world and their specific group that they're working with. So it's I like the idea of you offering a kind of a format and people either using yours or if they feel comfortable with it or changing the language to something that maybe they don't like the word resistance. They like something else as in terms of create or grow or build or other kind of language. But so talk about why resistance is a word that you approve of.
It's partly because of the history mm-hmm. of the Pledge of Resistance. It's partly because of my very strong feeling that this is the setting in which we find ourselves, as you were saying just a bit ago. We need to draw lines in the sand and say, you cannot go past this, at least with everything that's we're capable of, we're going to resist you. You have to know that there are going to be consequences if you do X, Y, and Z. Now, I'm the first one to say that nonviolence consists of constructive as well as obstructive action, but I think that this is the right tone for this particular statement. it doesn't preclude our building the alternative institutions that we always need to be doing. But in this conversation with this document, I think a pledge of resistance in more or less this format is the statement that we need to make right now. Now, I have, having said that, I have absolutely no objection if people want to take it and make their own use of it. Mm-hmm. But I do have this wild dream that on the 21st of this month in Washington, D.C., where I think about 200,000 women and men are expected in that march, my dream is that they would all take that pledge together. Like the famous episode in The Birth of Satyagraha in 1906.
Sati what?
Satyagraha means clinging to truth, Stephanie, and it's a term that Gandhi had to invent because nonviolence wasn't even in existence yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you remember the very dramatic scene, and if you've seen the Attenborough film, it was done quite well. The people said that they swore, as God is my witness, I will not I will not comply with this obnoxious law. And Gandhi said, whoa, you know, think over the significance of this. I don't want anyone to do this under any sort of coercion. I want you to stand up in assent only if you agree and you're willing to go the route. And so he gave him a little bit of time to think it over. And then he says, I will never forget this scene. I'm still remembering it 25 years later. Or 20 years later when he writes about it, that 5,000 men stood up as one person, and that was the beginning of Satyagraha. Mm-hmm. So just imagine the effect of thousands and thousands of people taking this pledge within earshot of the White House on January 21st. I think it would terrify them.
And okay, so... thank you very much for sharing the pledge. And for those of you tuning in, this is Nonviolence Radio, and we're going through a bit of nonviolence in the news. The interesting thing about nonviolence in the news is that we have to talk a little bit about the theory and history of what makes something work, whereas on the corporate media, you're given story after story, which are all reinforcing a certain kind of a history, a certain kind of view of the human being, but nobody's saying what it is. So nonviolence news has a little bit more responsibility to it. Michael, do you have any last events or things coming up that... or resources that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I have about 25 of them, Stephanie, so let me quickly okay. pick here. I want to point out that Nonviolent Peace Force has sent two protection folks to Standing Rock, Martha Hernandez Diaz mm-hmm. from Colombia and Tiago Wolfer from Brazil. They both have worked for Nonviolent Peace Force on and off for the last 9 years. Since they met at the NP training in Guatemala, and ever since then they've gotten married. Now, for important upcoming events, I should mention that tomorrow in this area, tomorrow or Sunday, depending on which assembly district you live in, you have the opportunity to remake the California Democratic Party by turning as many as 1,100 progressives into delegates to the California Convention. So go to Progressive Democrats for America to find out about that. And on the 29th of this month, the launch of the Season for Nonviolence, I will be giving a keynote address in Santa Rosa, I think at the Sonoma County Peace Center.
Great. And we'll have another show on January 20th. So look forward to talking more about that event then and also talking a little bit about life in a new era of a new presidency. So thanks so much for the nonviolence in the news, Michael Nagler. And want to thank all of our listeners. This is Nonviolence Radio. We used to be Peace Paradigm Radio. Want to thank all of the staff at the Meta Center for Nonviolence, definitely our mother station, KWMR, and all of our listeners. Thank you very much. Until the next time, get involved.
And he fought for equality. He felt so strongly that he trained himself, 'cause he realized first he'd have to change himself. He changed his clothes and decided to walk. Some days he practiced silence and refused to talk. When he was young, he studied to be a lawyer. And then he became a great spiritual warrior. He read from the scriptures of every religion, came to the realization that we're all God's children. Because he understood that we're all equal, he became a spokesman for the people. A karma yogi devoted to service, to spread truth and peace was his purpose. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world, just like Gandhi. Gandhi dedicated his life to the cause, even when it meant breaking unjust laws. He often faced prison and incarceration, but that only strengthened his determination. He said he would make every sacrifice, but that he would never kill or take a life. He used his heart instead of his fist, and he taught nonviolence as the way to resist. A peaceful soldier who used his mind to fight for the rights of humankind, but not just people, animals too. In his basic teaching, God is truth. He joined Muslims, Sikhs, and Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Jains, and Jews. All the many paths that lead into the light that shines bright inside of me and you. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Just like Gandhi. Gandhi taught an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind, and it takes more strength and faith to be kind. With that in mind, Gandhi took a stand against the foreign occupation of his land. When things got violent, Gandhi would fast, not eating for days until the riots would pass. But the biggest event that made the British halt is when Gandhi G decided to harvest salt. The British Empire installed a salt tax, and stealing salt was an unlawful act. So Gandhi and his peeps took to the streets, 10,000 deep they marched to the beach. But when they arrived, they were beaten with clubs, but they didn't fight back, instead they chose love. The foreign military realized they were wrong and eventually decided to go back home. You see, Gandhi G was a very great leader, but before all that, he was shy and meager. As a young child, he was just like you and me, before he became Mahatma Gandhi. The word Mahatma, it means great soul, and it's inside of us just waiting to unfold. If you follow your heart and act real bold, next time it'll be your story that's told. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world, just like Gandhi.
Soldier of peace.